So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review,
Horseman, you've threatened me. But you made a big mistake when you started messing with the little stingers. So before you make your next move,
take it over, Creed.
Well, I think we're going to Gordon Solie. We should be about ready for the appearance of
Sting. Forgive me for interrupting, but it looks like something's going on down here. The doors have opened. Security men are coming out. And it looks like, yes, it is indeed Sting and RoboCop are making their way out to the arena. RoboCop listening as he comes out through the light. And if you, well, I'll tell you one thing, four horsemen, watch out.
Watch
Sting.
Watch it.
And by.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting, where we are going to get into the time machine and go back to May the 19th of 1990. How are you doing today, Wei?
I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic.
I don't believe you.
Why?
Because you told me that you left Capital Combat to the last minute and you had to watch this all together. And this was a long show, Wei.
It wasn't that long. It was actually under 3 hours.
Felt longer.
Oh, well, actually, I guess they're all under 3 hours. What am I saying?
But you made it through alive.
I made it through. I had to. Well, we recorded.
Did you watch my VHS of it?
I did. We recorded,
oh, God.
We're recording this on Tuesday, and so last night we did review Raw. So I had to watch Raw, recorded our podcast, and then I started Capital Punishment, and then I actually.
It's Capital Combat.
Or Capital Combat. And then I actually fell asleep. I took a nap and then woke up and I finished the show. Now I'm at work. Now I'm recording.
Now you're ready to talk about Capital Combat.
Yeah, so over the past few hours, I've watched and talked about a lot of wrestling. So let's continue. What better?
You know, I was looking at this pay-per-view and I was going back and looking at, you know, how well this show did at the time, because this sounds like quite the obscure pay-per-view. 1990s WCW, they were coming off a very, very hot year in 1989 where they had the Flair-Terry Funk feud, the Flair-Steamboat feud, but business-wise, weren't doing tremendous going into 1990. Jim Herd was the booker here at this time. This
wasn't Ole Anderson one of the bookers at this time?
Ole Anderson was not... the booker at the time, it was, he might have been involved, I don't know 100%, because it changed so many times with Ole in and out with that company, but at this point, Jim Herd was the main guy at this point. There were many different eras of different guys in charge here, but nonetheless, this pay-per-view, which, this was 1990, when pay-per-view, I don't want to say was in its infancy, but certainly not available to the level it is today, and this pay-per-view did more buys than the giant Money in the Bank pay-per-view last summer, Wei, as I was noting to you before.
That's amazing. How is that possible?
RoboCop.
Capital Combat 1990, the return of RoboCop.
And I think that puts into perspective just how much pay-per-view has been affected here in 2012. And I was just reading about this interview Dixie Carter did about how pay-per-view is a dying industry. Dying industry, Wei. And yet, WrestleMania and UFC 145, two events within the span of 20 days, did 2 million buys worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
2 million buys in 3 weeks for this dying industry. If you include lockdown, then in the span of 20 days, there were 2,017,000 buys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well.
But pay-per-view here in 1990, thriving by today's standards for Capital Combat.
What number did this show do?
It was over 200. I should have checked before I checked this like a week ago. Forgot the actual number, but it was above Money in the Bank, which did 190.
Wow.
So.
So
this was a profitable show.
Well, then maybe Dixie's right. Maybe aside from the big shows and UFC, I guess.
Aside from products that are connecting with their audience, it's dead. Yeah. That's like, aside from the blockbuster movies,
but hey,
movies are dying.
Money in the Bank connected with the audience, wouldn't you say?
It did, just not enough people bought the pay-per-view.
Right.
Or the audience that it connected with most are people that listen to this show and simply stream the show.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, how much do you think it is affected by streaming as much as it is by, I guess, an oversaturation of pay-per-views?
I think streaming is certainly... I would say right now of WWE pay-per-views, I would imagine if streaming was non-existent, I think most of the people streaming would not be buying the pay-per-view, but it probably makes up, I would say, 15 to 20% right now.
Hmm.
That would be my guess. Hmm. Maybe a little higher for UFC, just because you're dealing with a larger base.
Mm-hmm. I find it's a lot harder to stream the UFCs.
That to me, listen, I am not on board with streaming and stuff, and to me, inconvenience is, that alone is worth purchasing a pay-per-view.
Sure.
And I think that's the one way you curb streaming, is that people love free stuff, but they also love non-headaches. And that if you're having a large party over for WrestleMania, you're going to order the show.
Absolutely.
If you, I don't think you want to be dependent on a stream. If it's just you watching something, I think you're more reticent to have to,
of course,
shift from site to site and risk getting a site shut down, and then you have to go find another feed and
you're
another
also,
feed. But that, to me, that's not an enjoyable three-hour experience. Watching a stream where there's buffering issues, where I might have to go find another link to find the show, and I'm going to miss stuff,
well,
that is not enjoyable to me.
If you're watching a show by yourself, too, you're also fielding that entire cost yourself.
Yep.
Whereas I'm sure with many people, when they watch the UFCs, it's a very hot product right now, and therefore you're probably going to have a lot more friends that are going to be interested in coming over and watching. So, you know, you split the cost that way. That's really the only way I buy shows, is if I have people over to watch them with me and we can split the cost, because I'm cheap.
I always invite you to come to the radio show, and you can watch every wrestling pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. How many, when you go to watch UFC, you always say, oh, I'm staying in Scarborough to watch it with my friends.
Yeah.
How many typically are you hanging out with? How many people is this?
There's usually at least a good group of three, me and two other guys, and occasionally.
And you go to a bar,
four
don't
or five
you?
People. Yeah, we find one of the.
That to me would be what, like, I would much rather go out, watch it at a bar. That's where I remember watching Silva Sonnen, the first fight, at a bar, and it was awesome because
it was
full, and everyone was into that fight. When we went to the Diesel Playhouse, that was a lot of fun.
It's always a lot of fun. To me, it's one of the things that one of the events that I look forward to with me and my friends every month is to go out and enjoy one of these shows, because it's you're gonna go out to a bar anyway, most likely, right? So why not go and you pay for your food. We try to look for places that don't have cover, but even if there's cover, it's still a worthwhile time. It's just a good time watching with fans and enjoying live sports at a bar.
What's throwing a change to me is that, first off, there was like the inclusion of all the Facebook fights, and I've always want to watch all the fights. There's a lot of times on the Facebook fights I'm very interested in seeing all of the fights, and that would necessitate, well, I got to start watching at home. I'm just going to watch it there, have people over, and then we started doing the TSN shows, so obviously you can't go out to watch them anymore. But to me, it would be great if there would be like some bar in Toronto that they would put the Facebook fights up, like with an HDMI cable.
Yeah, that's not
and then
a bad
and
idea.
Then you order the pay per view. If there was one, like, just a place that fight fans knew to go to, and you could watch 5 hours of fighting. Think about the business you would get. Fight fans, 6 hours they're in your bar.
Oh God,
spending money.
I don't know about that though. 6 hours in a bar.
I'd do it. I would totally. If I didn't have to do the TSN show, that would be, I would get there at 5 o'clock and I'd stay there till midnight.
Well, that is the question, is it not? How many John Pollocks are there?
This is Toronto. I think Toronto is an anomaly where you would get More than you would expect, I think.
Maybe. I can't imagine spending that much time in a bar, though. These are...
Listen. As I said, Wei Ting is the most hardcore casual fan I've ever met. Nah, this is too much. I just don't care enough.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Would you have gone to a bar to watch Capital Combat if you were of legal age at, what, the age of six?
Definitely. Yeah, 6 years old. The return of RoboCop, I'm there.
This was actually a promotional tie-in with RoboCop 2 coming out. Did you ever see the RoboCop movies?
I saw the first RoboCop movie. I don't think I completely understood it. I just thought, hey, cool.
I've never seen... What's the premise? Is he just a superhuman cop?
No, he used to be a cop, and then he was injured in combat. And then they...
Capital Combat?
Yes. And then they turned him into a robot. Half robot, half cop.
Amazing that this guy is not on the level of, you know, X-Men or part of the Avengers or... Sure. RoboCop is not as well remembered in 2012.
No, it's not.
Didn't stand the test of time.
No, it's not. But here we are. He is remembered fondly in the world of pro wrestling as a result of this episode of NWA WCW.
I didn't even look this up. This was all the return of RoboCop. I didn't know
RoboCop. That is the official subtitle of this show.
Yes, that was, as Jim Ross has to announce, welcome everybody to Capital Combat featuring the return of RoboCop. Jim Ross having to call that was just too much for
this
me.
This was definitely my favorite part of this entire show, was hearing these esteemed legendary announcers like Jim Ross and Gordon Solie.
And Bob Caudle.
Talk about RoboCop.
Gordon Solie stole the show for me.
As if he was a real person that was alive in this WCW universe, in the same plane of existence as Ric Flair, as Dusty Rhodes, as Ricky Steamboat, as Lex Luger, and RoboCop, a half robot, half cop. It's just, he's hanging out backstage.
Gordon Solie was just so good. Jim, I am outside of the locker room of RoboCop. And as you can see, no one will allow me into the locker room, but I am going to stay here, and we will attempt to receive word from RoboCop.
The most serious delivery you can.
This was like he was on the green at like the Masters, yep. Reporting live. RoboCop unavailable for comment. It's just like dry ice is coming from his room.
This show is great.
WCW 1990, folks. We need to spend. Unfortunately, these events are so hard to find. I would love to review more of these, but you always want to make them available to our listeners to see as well. And this, I happen to have this on VHS.
We got very lucky.
How did you make it through? I hated watching this. My VHS sucked of it. It was like a second, third generation copy of this event.
Yeah, well, I'm not. I mean, I...
And I paid for this, folks, so don't get on me here. I paid for Capital Combat.
From eBay, yes, you did. I don't have an issue watching old VHS. I love analog technology.
Oh,
like,
I hate it. Digital all the way.
Well, I like simply being able to rewind and seeing every single frame. It just feels better. But I'm kind of a snob when it comes to that.
You're a snob for liking the lower end quality. You're the opposite of a snob.
Yeah.
There's like HD snobs. You're an SD snob.
I'm an SD snob, yeah.
All right. May 19th, 1990, Washington, D.C. at the D.C. Armory.
The D.C. Armory.
Yeah. Come for the drinks, stay for the wrestling.
This place looked kind of small.
Well, it was the D.C. Armory. Why don't you look it up? I bet you it's been torn down by now. Yeah. Figure out how many probably this holds. Probably 6,000?
7,500.
Wow.
Reportedly.
Wow. Reported. They had a marching band do the national anthem at the start of this show. This was a unique start.
Well, they are in the Capitol.
That means marching band.
Yep.
Surprised there was no fake president here.
Who was it? It was George Bush Sr.
They announce that Tony Schiavone tells us that we are awaiting RoboCop. Schiavone had just come back from the WWF at this point. His one-year stint in the World Wrestling Federation.
What happened? Why did he come back so soon?
He came back because, I don't know if it was because Jim Herd had gotten to power and they wanted to phase Jim Ross out. And I think Schiavone, first of all, he just wasn't happy in WWF because of the travel. I mean, he was based in Georgia, and That was, you know, the home base for the NWA, whereas the WWF, he was on the road constantly all the way around. So I don't think he enjoyed the travel, mm-hmm. and I think he was brought back with the assumption that he'd be moving in and Jim Ross would kind of be phased out. And Ross would, he'd still be with the company until 92. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's where we are here. They say that we're awaiting RoboCop, and then they throw it to the announcers for the night, Jim Ross and Bob Caudle, to plug three title matches and the return of RoboCop.
Yes. The return of RoboCop. It's going to get some used to, getting used to.
We start the show off with a six-man tag. It's Kevin Sullivan, very young Kevin Sullivan, teaming up with Cactus Jack Manson and Bam Bam Bigelow, who is joined by Sir Oliver Humperdinck.
Mm-hmm.
So the two that had left the WWF, they kept the act together with Bigelow and Humperdinck.
Oh.
Humperdinck was his manager during that late 80s run.
Right.
Taking on the Road Warriors and Norman, the former Shockmaster. Or maybe...
Bastion Booger, was he not?
Sorry, this was Mike Shaw. You're right. I'm thinking of... Yes, Shockmaster would become Big Josh. This was Norman. Yes, Mike Shaw.
Big Josh. I don't.
That's who. When Shockmaster surprisingly didn't get over, they repackaged him as a Big Josh.
Big Josh. Wow.
I think so.
Way better.
The Warriors came out driving motorcycles, and then Animal starts off with Jack. Norman comes in, splashes Jack, and leg drops the pajama-cladden Norman. According to Bob Caudle, Animal clotheslines Bigelow to the floor, but then lands on his feet. And Ross says that Bigelow used to be a bounty hunter before getting into wrestling.
Is it what?
A bounty hunter. He would go kill men for a price.
Okay.
Bigelow hit a vertical suplex to Norman for a two count, and then they double team Norman. And Jack hits a neck breaker as he goes over the top to Norman, who's on the top rope. Finally makes the hot tag to Animal. All six are in the ring fighting. Norman and Bigelow fight to the floor, and Hawk hits a top rope clothesline to pin Kevin Sullivan. This one went 9 minutes and 38 seconds.
And how did Hawk and Sullivan become the legal men?
Well,
they tagged an Animal.
You're supposed to. Maybe it was a tornado rules.
Okay, fine.
Animal and Hawk didn't do a whole lot of selling during this time period. That's why Norman was here for them.
Did they ever do any selling?
Well, definitely not at this point, and didn't make it a staple of their career.
No, I found them pretty sloppy as usual, the Legion of Doom.
How they were introduced, the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors.
Yeah. Well, what's the deal with that?
That's how they were introduced in the NWA, and then when they came over to the WWF, they felt that they were too well known as the Road Warriors. We're signing this team because everyone knows who they are, but let's take away the name that most are familiar with them.
Was there no legal issue? I thought that was always the reason why they couldn't name themselves the Road Warriors.
No, because at that point, the Road Warriors had wrestled in a number of different territories as the Road Warriors. So at that point, I mean,
it was just a case of Vince wanting to repackage them under their own.
I think so, yeah. Give them the shoulder pads and stuff. And
okay.
They got the Legion of Doom, which people still kind of knew them as, but... The Road Warriors are what they're distinctly remembered as.
We also saw in this match a very thin and young Cactus Jack Manson. And as you would expect, he was bumping like crazy in this match.
Yes, this was very early on before he had hit any of his fame. He had just been doing, he'd been working in Texas. He had been working, he had done some independent shots with the other job matches with the WWF at this point, but still very young in his career. This was his ultimate classic wrestling days. 1990, yeah. He was working a lot in Texas and Memphis.
Yes.
Then out came from the City of Sunshine, Johnny Ace.
Uh-huh.
A man who can lay claim to wrestling on a pay-per-view in 1990, in May of 1990, and then headlining a pay-per-view in May of 2012.
That is right. Well, him?
Is this the only guy on this show who is on?
No. His opponent in this match.
Well, he's not. I was going to say who might be on this Over the Limit show is.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, you're right. His opponent here.
Listen, in fact, three participants in this matchup are active members of the current WWE roster.
One owns the other's contract.
Yes.
It's Johnny Ace against Mean Mark Calloway, accompanied by his manager, who was all over this show, Theodore Long.
I felt like I was watching an episode of Raw.
Long before he had grandchildren that he had to work to stay employed for, taking on his future boss, or in the corner here of me and Mark, taking on Johnny Ace.
Amazing, actually, when you consider it. I mean, 12 years ago, and now these three men, in particular Johnny Ace and Teddy Long, still employed in on-air roles, prominent on-air roles.
Let's be honest, Way. If I was talking to a six-year-old Way, and I said, okay, of these three, one of them is going to be one of the greatest characters in wrestling history and is going to be one of the biggest stars in the entire industry in 22 years.
Yeah.
I would have said Johnny Ace.
Yeah,
Mean Mark looked like the ultimate. He was Gunner. He was Gunner. That was his gimmick here. Mean Mark, to the point that this is how Jim Ross sold Mean Mark. His favorite animal is a snake, and his favorite singer is Ozzy Osbourne. That's all we know about Mean Mark.
Well, what do mean people like? They like metal. They like snakes. He's a mean Mark.
I always hate names like this. It was I remember the Sinister Minister doing an interview once talking about how TNA wanted to do a promo where he called himself evil. And he said, if I'm an evil person, why would I ever call myself evil?
Yeah.
I don't believe myself that. Do you think Osama bin Laden would call himself a terrorist?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows what he is, but the guy should never have to say what he is.
Absolutely.
And that, ever since I heard that interview, names like Mean Mark, never a fan of. And this, Terry Funk came up with the idea of Mean Mark.
What is a good thing that we can alliterate with M? Mean.
Maybe they could come up with a third M. Mean Mark Manson.
Okay.
The brother of Cactus Jack Manson. Yeah.
At this point, Mean Mark was, in fact, despite being mean and into snakes, he was also introduced as a former basketball star by Jim Ross.
That's mean.
Yeah, yeah.
From pounding the mean backboards.
Hey, yeah.
I got giddy during this match when Jim Ross plugged that coming up later, we are going to introduce the Slam-O-Meter.
The Slam-O-Meter. This was the 90s, man.
This was the stupidest idea.
This was the 80s, actually transitioning into the 90s, so.
Oh, Lord. Johnny Ace leaped over the top to Mark on the floor. Ace hit a high reverse cross off the top and followed that up with an arm drag. Then Ace goes to the floor and Teddy Long starts stomping on Johnny Ace. Eventually chases after Long, gets attacked from behind by Mean Mark. States that Ross notes that these two men have their best years ahead of them. Which was accurate for one of them. Johnny Ace, well, in Japan, he would have a good run in the 90s. But Ross notes that we'll be going to Gordon Solie in a few minutes at RoboCop's locker room. Mark gets the heat, an inside cradle by Johnny Ace for a two count, and then Johnny Ace makes his comeback with a drop kick and monkey flip, misses a top rope clothesline, and Mark hits the dreaded heart punch, and he then goes to the top, scales the ropes. He did like the old school without holding a guy's arm, just scaled the ropes and hit an elbow drop. I thought impressive by 1990 standards for a big man.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Taker... he's always, you know, regarded as a big man, but his wrestling style is really that of a very average, like not average is the wrong word, but like a guy much smaller than what his size should be doing.
You're right.
It's very acrobatic.
He's always been presented as like a big man kind of, but doesn't work a big man style, and it works for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be the exception rather than the rule, because that's who I see. When I watch Matt Morgan, I see a guy who wants to emulate The Undertaker and work a style that is not conducive to being a big man. And I think with Matt Morgan, he doesn't connect at all. And I think that's – The Undertaker has so much stock amongst the audience that this guy is just
– it's the character as well.
Exactly. Matt the Morgan. Character is so over that The Undertaker has so much liberty of what he can get away with and what he can pull off, and it's believable.
But
whereas
also,
Matt Morgan, there's no – built up anything.
See, Taker is Taker's character is a monster. He does the slow walking. He does the, sometimes he does the no selling. Like, everything about him screams monster, except the on occasion where he would dive out of the ring or maybe, you know, do a giant elbow drop or something like that. So I think those moments of contrast really make him, make his offense stand out. Whereas Morgan dresses like a regular guy, looks like a regular guy, carries himself like a you know, he like he might as well be
he's a giant that wrestles like he's
his character
not a giant.
Yeah, his character is that of a normal person.
It's like he ignores his size rather than accentuates it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the finish looked good, but this match went very long. 10 minutes and 38 seconds.
All the matches on this show were very long. We had 8 matches on this. Was it 8? Wait.
7 or 8.
We had 8 matches on this show, and most of them went near the 20-minute mark.
Well, that was the big calling card, was at the time in the NWA, whether you were into the characters or not, the work in the NWA Farley, does that make a sense? It surpassed that of the WWF at the time because, I mean, you were getting just big monster matches in the WWF, but it was the characters were so over the top, and it was just they were better marketed, but the NWA was always like, we've got the real talent here, and we let our guys go, and they can work, but not everyone fit into the category of a Flair or a Steamboat.
No, not everyone. This match itself went 10 minutes, and I thought of a pretty generic matchup. It was actually my first time seeing Johnny Ace wrestle, and I felt like he had a very decent, generic, high-flying babyface style. You think we'll see this at Over the Limit, the same Johnny Ace?
A high cross off the top? Yeah. Maybe.
Big drop kick? So we'll at least see a drop kick from Johnny Ace. He had some nice drop kicks.
22 years ago he did. I don't know what his vertical would be like. Though he looks like he's kept good care of himself.
Yeah.
Hasn't aged too poorly.
Oh.
The replay featured the elbow drop from the middle of the ropes. An 8.2 on the slam-o-meter.
Oh, Jesus.
Where there was a graphic, and when the arm hit the chest, it fluctuated and hit an 8.2.
And there is a sound effect, too. You could hear a crunch when the elbow dropped. So not a great match, but good for novelty factor when you rewatch it today.
So Gordon Solie approaches the locker room, and he is flanked by security guards and reports that no one can get in, and Sting is seeking revenge on the Horsemen for being attacked in Corpus Christi, Texas, and RoboCop is here to protect the thousands of little Stingers and says that nothing is happening here, but he will stay there.
You mentioned how the NWA is the show where they're real workers, and it's the matches are they're not over the top. These are real, believable characters, and yet on the same show we got RoboCop.
Well, this was the transition into 1990, and with the likes of Jim Herd. I mean, if Jim Herd was the guy who wanted Ric Flair to cut his hair, get an earring, and turn him into a gladiator.
Okay.
That was his idea, to update Ric Flair, because in 1990, he was too old.
Mm.
He's just too old.
Mm-hmm.
I think he turned 40 in 1990, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And they were talking about, well, we got to prepare for the future, and Sting will replace Ric Flair. And little did we know that a teenage Dixie Carter was, wait a minute, by the time I have a company, those two.
These are the stars of tomorrow.
Dixie Carter's in like this time machine. At this time, in 1990, you had Sting and Flair feuding in WCW. You had Hulk Hogan on top in the WWF. Probably kills her that the Ultimate Warrior won't come in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You could have 1990 all over again.
Yeah.
Maybe RoboCop will make its way.
Oh, wow.
The next return of RoboCop in 2012.
Why haven't they rebooted that franchise?
I don't know. Every other franchise has gotten second, third, fourth wind.
Yeah, RoboCop.
RoboCop. Tony Schiavone is with the Rock and Roll Express, who are getting ready for a strap match tonight against the Fabulous Freebirds. And Ricky Morton, cuts a promo on winning the tag titles. Makes sense?
What a novel concept.
Well,
a team comes into a company, their goal is to, what, win those things?
Well, that's all well and good, but they weren't facing the tag champions tonight. This whole promo was about facing the champions.
Yeah, so what? But they're lining out their ultimate goal.
Fair enough.
This is just the first step.
Fair enough. Then they go over to Robert Gibson, who cuts a promo on the Horsemen.
Yeah.
They are not facing either
tonight.
Well,
that is their next ultimate goal. One of their other ultimate goals.
And then they finished discussing Lex Luger leaving the hospital today for the main event. So these two did a great job of getting over the tag champions, getting the horseman over his heels, and setting up the main event tonight. But nothing to do with their strap match.
That I do agree with, because I had no idea after this promo what their match was coming up. I had no idea that they were facing the...
For those that watch this event, this was completely legit. Lex Luger was in the hospital for staph infection and had just been released that morning to work the match on in the main event.
In storyline, they were they positioned him as being taken out by the Horseman.
Yes,
correct?
Yeah, the Horseman
with a knee injury.
Yes, they had attacked Luger, and the heat was Sting. Sting was brought into the Horseman, and then they did this famous angle in February where they turned on him in Corpus Christi, mm-hmm. And that's where everything had set up, and they were planning that they were going to put the title on Sting, but then he injured his knee, and that took him out of action for like 6 months at this point, and kind of Lex Luger was the transitional challenger until Sting was healthy to come back and beat Flair for the title. Mm. We continue onwards here with Captain Mike Rotunda wearing his sailor's hat.
What is he a captain of?
A ship. That has docked somewhere. Teaming with Wildfire Tommy Rich to take on the Samoan SWAT team. SST.
What is Tommy Rich's gimmick?
He won the NWA title and held it for a very short period of time a decade ago.
He's not like a rich guy, like Richie
no,
Rich?
No. That's just his last name, Tommy Rich.
All right.
The Samoan SWAT team, they're doing all this praying and these hand signals for the first 2.5 minutes of this match.
Well, they're trying to gain heat for this ritual, but the announcers really weren't.
They were praying that in their lifetime the Samoan stereotypes would die down.
Mm-hmm.
Rich body slammed Fatu, but then misses a headbutt off the top. Rotunda and Rich get the advantage, but the Samoans make a comeback. They double team Rotunda behind the referee's back. They fight to the floor. Rotunda gets kicked in the face, but makes it back to the ring. And then they continue with the heat on Rotunda. They make a tag, but Randy Anderson misses it. They continue to double-team Rotunda. Then they finally make a hot tag. Tommy Rich applies a sleeper, but the ref's back is turned. Fatu comes off the top, and he hits... I wrote Johnny Ace here, who was not in this match. Whatever. One of the Samoans pinned Tommy Rich.
Yeah. They cheated to win, basically.
17 minutes and 54 seconds.
This was a long match.
This was way too long for these four.
Yeah, I mean...
Holy shit.
I know in our day and age, we often complain about there not being enough long matches on TV or enough matches, period, on TV. And perhaps I'm conditioned to that style.
I want
style.
Quality over quantity.
Well, perhaps I'm conditioned to that style because, like, a lot of these matches were just way too long for me. And I think it's also a combination of me not really being familiar with all the people involved and not caring enough to see them for 20 minutes.
This match was just way, way, way too long.
Yeah.
Tony Schiavone is with the Steiner Brothers. And Schiavone asks Scott about... Are you angling for a big match with Hogan in the WWF? And Scott said, "Oh shit."
He didn't say that.
No, he didn't. That was in my interview.
Oh, yeah. Bullshit.
Anyway, he says, Scott says that they've won a lot of matches, but they've also lost a few. And no one is unbeatable. And they came to Washington to suplex Doom on their head and clothesline them.
Who's a better promo, Scott or Rick?
Scott, by far. I was never big into Rick, even though I share a birthday with the man.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, me and Rick Steiner, March the 9th. Gary Michael Capetta then announces some contest winners in the crowd, and they cut to this couple in their mid-40s just standing there looking amused. And
what are we doing here?
Yeah.
We signed up for this thing, and now we're here.
Missy Hyde is brought down to the ring with... some world-renowned hairstylist for the next match.
Jay Tapper.
Did you look this guy up? Is he legit?
No.
So we've got... this was the best hair versus hair match I've ever seen in my life. Paul Ellering, who was already bald. The guy had, like, no hair left to speak of. Taking on Theodore Long, who had a skullet at this time.
Yeah.
The dreaded skullet.
Quite the skullet.
Oh, what a hair versus hair match this was going to be. Long was wearing boxing headgear and gloves. And I'm going to say that Teddy Long got the Scott Putski Award on this show.
Wow.
This dude was jacked.
What? Teddy Long?
Did you see him on this show?
Did you see Paul Ellering on this show? Did you see
I'm making the contrast, though, to Grandfather Teddy here.
Okay. Well, perhaps.
Teddy Long was jacked here in 1990 when he was paired with Doom.
Well, listen, we still had the Steiners coming up. We still had Doom coming up.
Yeah, you're right. There was a lot of juice flowing at the time.
Okay, fine.
That was just the world that they lived in.
Well, let's give it to Teddy Long. A swerve.
Long fought him off with his boxing gloves, and they play it up that he's got an object in the gloves as Ellering takes the gloves off, scoop slams Teddy, and then knocks him out with the glove and pins him. And this was short. They begin to shave off the remains of his hair, but then he regains consciousness and runs to the back. So really, all they cut was like, there was like dangling parts of his hair, and they cut the dangling parts and kept his back end of his hair. I don't even know how to describe
this. They cut out the let of the skullet.
The let of the skullet. He just had the skull fuzz. Uh-huh. A horrible hair versus hair match. Thank God it was short, and you didn't even get a payoff.
I thought the boxing glove deal was kind of neat.
Shivani is then with the Four Horsemen. Ole Anderson, Arn Anderson, Sid wearing a just ungodly looking tuxedo. He looked like this guy was holding drinks for Ole and Arn. And Ole says that they never allow a title to leave the hands of Ric Flair. And then Flair walks in, cuts a Ric Flair 1990 promo,
mm-hmm.
talking about Lex Luger, and says that he will be a one-legged athlete for the rest of his career. Arn then spoke. They never let Sid talk. He just stood there. He was the muscle. He was the quiet one.
Yep.
And great promo here from the Horsemen.
Yeah.
Then we go on to Brian Pillman and Tom Zenk, better known at this time as Flying Brian and the Z-Man, taking on the Midnight Express, who are accompanied by Jim Cornette, for the United States Tag Team titles. Pillman and Zenk defending the gold. And Cornette got on the microphone as he introduced them, and then announces that Cornette is to be put into a cage at ringside to avoid... he tries to get away from this cage, but the babyfaces throw him in, so Cornette is hung up in a cage to prevent interference.
Mm-hmm.
Zenk and Pillman get the advantage. They play up Cornette not being able to help the team regroup as they go to the floor. Midnight Express got the heat on Pillman. They kept him in their corner, attacked his throat, which Jim Ross played up with all the surgeries that Pillman has had in his career. Eaton hits a top rope elbow drop, but Pillman kicks out. Crowd really into Brian Pillman here, just as the baby face selling. And I thought Jim Ross did a great job of getting Pillman over here. Eaton hit a top rope leg drop, gets another near fall. Pillman counters a tilt-a-whirl with his own slam and makes the huge hot tag to Zenk. They hit the rocket launcher onto Tom Zenk, but he kicks out. Eaton then misses Zenk in the corner. Lane breaks the count after a reverse cross by Zenk, but the ref's back is turned. Midnight Express get the advantage as Lane kicks Zenk in the back of the head, and then Eaton gets an inside cradle, and they steal the titles from the babyfaces. I like this match.
A very good
match. Good tag match.
Yeah, a very good match. Another match that was given plenty of time. Actually, this was the longest match on the show at 20 minutes, but...
Wow.
Very good, and... good fast-paced work from all four of the guys here, especially Brian.
Four guys that could go.
Yeah.
They plug the Great American Bash coming up in July, and then they throw to Gordon Solie with RoboCop coming out of the locker room with security, but the signal cuts out. Oh, they're exclusive. Up in smoke.
That means this is serious. Maybe the interference from RoboCop's body affected the camera.
Yeah, affected the signal. Sting comes out, and he's attacked from behind by the Horsemen, who then put Sting into the cage that was at ringside for Jim Cornette. And as they put him in the cage, RoboCop motors out and tears the hinges off the door as the Horsemen flee in panic at this cartoon come to life.
I'm watching the Four Horsemen run away from RoboCop. A man dressed in a... metal outfit walking like a robot.
I could only envision Ole Anderson being instructed of his task for tonight. You are going to run in fear from RoboCop. I'm going to do what? So At least this segment was short. This was all we really got of RoboCop.
I was disappointed. I wanted to see a match with RoboCop. I wanted to see him do a hot tag, and he could just come out and deflect people with his armor. He has a gun in his thigh as well. Did you know that?
He had a gun?
He has a gun in his thigh the entire time. He should have taken it out.
This is according to Wikipedia, okay, on Jim Herd, okay? Before beginning his role in WCW, Herd had been a station manager for St. Louis television station KPLR, which broadcast the then popular Wrestling at the Chase. Later on, he served as a regional manager for Pizza Hut. Many wrestling personalities, fans, and workers have openly criticized Herd for his lack of knowledge of the wrestling business. Ric Flair in particular stated that Herd, quote, knew nothing about wrestling other than the fact that the station he ran on had a hot show. During his run in WCW, Herd tried to compete with Vince McMahon and the WWF by introducing the same kind of gimmicks that were a part of the McMahon's WWF at the time, alienating the diehard NWA audience. For example, he once tried to come up with a tag team called the Hunchbacks, with the gimmick in which they could not be pinned because their humps would prevent their shoulders from touching the mats. And after that idea was rejected by the booking committee, he came up with the bell-wearing ding-dongs. After that, he came up with Big Josh, a lumberjack with dancing bears. Stan Hansen left the organization and returned to All Japan after the idea was pitched to him to become part of the comedic cowboy stable, the Desperados. Jim Cornette and Stan Lane also left the organization in October of 1990, breaking up the Midnight Express, leaving Bobby Eaton on his own, after Herd would blame his many failures on Cornette and others. Even the Road Warriors, as Animal has stated on WWE Home Videos, had a fallout with Herd as well and resigned from WCW in June of 1990.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you, Jim Herd, for providing us with countless hours of things to talk about on this podcast.
Well, it's a time. Wrestling would be boring if there weren't big failures to lament on and learn from, maybe.
No.
No, well, don't learn from them. Repeat.
We just reviewed a show from 5 years ago that featured God in the main event.
That's true. So RoboCop made the save. Tony Schiavone is then with the returning Junkyard Dog, who apparently was on the Big T diet. This man looked gigantic. Huge. He says he's looking to take out the Horseman and Mean Mark. And then Jim Cornette rushes in, saying that it's time for the Midnight Express to chat about winning the titles, and tells JYD to leave, and he runs down Junkyard Dog. Junkyard Dog then gives out his mother's address, Jim Cornette's mother's address, as to where he has been.
Yeah.
I've been with your mama.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he meant to say. And goes to hit him with the racket, but Junkyard Dog stops him. This was...
That's
the downside of JYD's career here.
I thought Cornette was good. Cornette sold this pretty well.
Can you articulate for the listeners the Rock and Roll Express's entrance?
No, I can't.
They came out on a moving platform with a jukebox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well.
Because they were what? The Rock and Roll Express. They travel with a touring jukebox.
Yeah.
This was so corny. It was a Rock and Roll Express against the Freebirds. Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin in a corporal punishment match.
What does that mean?
It was a leather strap match. Jim Ross didn't even know what the rules were because they hung the straps at ringside, and Jim Ross thought that they'd have to tie each other together with the strap, but that was not the case. There was this old man who was just going crazy at ringside, yelling at Michael Hayes. Gibson and Morton were the first to get the straps, and they attack the Freebirds and send them to the floor. Ross discusses how he played hooky as a child and then got whipped with belts like that by his parents. Poor man.
Yeah. That's...
Could have been worse. His parents could have made him rap.
Yeah, or
as punishment.
Or lit him on fire or made them kiss his ass.
The Rock and Roll Express, they apply a double figure four spot to Hayes and Garvin, but Hayes rakes the eyes of Morton. The Freebirds get the advantage on Gibson, then toss him to the floor, eventually makes the hot tag, and immediately they get heat on Morton and wear him down with punches and a choke by Hayes. Hayes then chokes Morton with the leather strap on the floor until finally making a hot tag to Gibson. All four are in the ring as Morton gets sent to the floor and the Freebirds double-team Gibson. And Hayes hits a DDT to Gibson, plays to the crowd, and then goes for another DDT. But Morton goes off the top rope with a sunset flip to pin Hayes for the win. The moral of the story was that Michael Hayes decided to gloat about hitting his DDT, and it cost the Freebirds the match.
Mm-hmm. The crowd seemed really hot for all of this.
They definitely were into especially the Rock and Roll Express. Mm-hmm. Then Tony Schiavone is with Doug Furness, who had just started with WCW, and he spoke to Lex Luger earlier today, and he will be ready tonight. Both obviously doing strongman gimmicks, with Doug Furness coming in here. He had worked in Kentucky, I believe, is where he was working, and had come in here. He was tight with Kevin Sullivan. So, Doug Furness there. This was his brief early 90s WCW run. Then we go to the Steiner Brothers against Doom, accompanied by Theodore Long, who managed everyone in this company.
Yeah.
Him and Jim Cornette.
Long wears a do-rag after having just been shaved.
And Rick Steiner pulled it off to reveal his non-haircut.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big fat guy in the crowd taunting Doom, and Reed just says to the camera, "We'll beat up the Steiners, and then we'll beat up these geeks, too." Butch Reed was a lot of fun during this match. Mm-hmm. He would just yell incoherently at the camera throughout the match. Scott Steiner shoves the referee, and this begins the match, as Simmons takes a German suplex, and Doom gets sent to the floor to regroup with Teddy. Rick Steiner continues with the advantage, and Reed goes to the floor. Scott sends him into the steel barricade. Then Rick hits a pile driver to Simmons and clotheslines him to the floor. Like, the first, 8 minutes of this, it was all Steiners on offense here. They had a familiar trait with the Road Warriors. We don't sell, which for baby faces is not always makes for the best combination. But I enjoyed the interaction here with these four.
It was only the beginning of the match. Later on, it would be Scott that would be selling and selling.
Yeah, Reed finally tosses Rick to the floor. They get the brief advantage. Ross calls Simmons Burt Reynolds' favorite wrestler.
Why is that?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Maybe Burt Reynolds is a big wrestling fan. Doom finally get the heat on Scott after a double axe handle off the top, and they prevent Scott from tagging Rick. There's a pile driver by Scott to Scott by Butch Reed, but then Scott comes back with the Frankensteiner.
Mm-hmm.
Hits it to Simmons, tags Rick in. Then Scott sends Reed to the floor, double vertical suplex to Simmons, and the ref gets distracted by Teddy Long, and then Reed hits Rick from behind on the ropes, and then Simmons lands on top, and they get the win with the ref distracted here. So Doom are your winners.
Doom are your winners. This was an okay match.
And this is for the tag titles, right?
Yes.
Yes. So Doom are your new champions.
This was an okay match featuring four heavyweight power wrestlers, I'd say. But at 20 minutes again, they really lost me for much of it.
They went long. So Butch Reed is he's with Tony Schiavone, him and Simmons. They do the interview. And as Schiavone goes to wrap it up, Reed gets one more line in, and he says, "And one more thing, Doom rules, baby."
There you go.
Had to get his shit in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go to our main event. It's Ric Flair defending the WCW title against Lex Luger in a steel cage, which it wasn't the fencing cage, but it was like...
It was like a Hell in a Cell.
It was a Hell in a Cell, but with the squares.
Yes, with bigger gaps and not a completely covered roof.
Yes.
But the size-wise, it was basically Luger versus Flair in a Hell in a Cell.
And Luger, at this point, was the United States champion, and Ric Flair was accompanied by woman to the ring. Early on, the referee, Mike Jackson, goes to search woman's gloves for any objects and finds what Ross identifies as an international object. Because you weren't allowed to say foreign on Turner Broadcasting at this point.
That would be offensive.
Yes. Luger with a series of power spots early on. Earlier in the year, these two had had a phenomenal match. Luger and Flair had very good chemistry together. But Luger, he hits these power spots. They go to the floor where Flair gets the advantage with chops. Goes after the knee of Luger, playing up the storyline attack. They fight up the cage. Flair's head is rammed into the cage and he juices. Begs off Luger as they get back into the ring. Then they fight back up the cage and Flair's head again gets rammed into the cage. There were fans here. There were four fans who had L-E-X. And the last guy had an exclamation point on their shirt.
Well, you have four friends.
A first and last for everything. Flair gets the heat attacking the knee as Flair is bleeding from his forehead. Luger begins his comeback, but then Arn and Ole come down to the ring, and they start to climb the cage as Luger continues a series of clotheslines and gets a near fall. Then Sting comes down to the ring to attack Ole and Arn, as well as Sid, and Sting's got backup. But it's not RoboCop. It's El Gigante.
El Gigante.
However the fuck you say his name.
Yeah.
What a stupid name.
Giant Gonzalez from WWF. At this point, El Gigante. Teaming up with Sting. Sting has a lot of friends. What happened to RoboCop? Why not?
He's got a lot of superhero friends. It was like they were creating the Justice League here.
Yeah.
The cage begins to rise as Barry Windham shows up and slips under the cage and attacks Lex Luger as he's going to apply the torture rack. He attacks Lex Luger, and they call for the bell. Disqualification at 17 minutes and 21 seconds. Arn then runs in. They all get the advantage. Jim Ross points out that Ole Anderson had run off and had the cage rise up, so they at least explain that. The ref is thrown out, and it's 3-on-1 on Luger, and they leave him beaten down, and I thought it was an okay match.
Yeah, I did too.
But a shitty finish.
Yeah. Well, they wanted to delay this feud, looks like.
There was a lot of behind the scenes of this as well. Jim Herd, they were pretty adamant. They wanted to put the title on Luger. And Ric Flair put his foot down and said no because he thought the money was in Sting winning the title. Hmm. Sting was going to win the title, but then it injured his knee. And that was what they would do a few months later at the Great American Bash. And I think that was the right call in hindsight rather than Flair and Sting was your match you were building to.
Yeah.
But they really wanted to put the title on Luger, and Luger was pissed at Ric for not dropping the title here. But afterwards, Schiavone was with Ric Flair. His blood was covering his face. He says the Horsemen are better. He is still the champion. And then Sting comes and attacks Flair with Gigante beside him. And that's how the show ends, with Sting attacking Ric Flair and pretty much set up your main event for your next pay-per-view with Sting returning to action and taking on the world champion. Mm-hmm. So, good show, not great show. The RoboCop stuff was kept to a minimum. Some matches, though, just dragged.
Yeah.
Some were just way too long, like the Samoan SWAT team going 17 and a half minutes.
That was a little
uncalled for.
I feel like if you're, you know, if I was a fan that was following all these guys at the time, if I was a bigger fan of this era of pro wrestling, I think I would have really enjoyed some of these matches. But I can't say that I am, unfortunately. So a lot of these matches were kind of just lost on me. And but the wrestling was good. I mean, don't get me wrong. Especially even the main event, I thought it was quite good. So I give this maybe a 6.5.
I give this one a 4.5 out of 10. I just thought the show dragged a lot. And for those that, I mean, criticize Lex Luger, I mean, this was probably the era where, I mean, when he was in with the right guy, he could have some stellar matches. Him and Ric Flair had some fantastic matches. You can go on YouTube right now. There's like a 45-minute match those two had earlier in 1990. Phenomenal match. So if you want to go see Lex Luger at his working best, this is the era to check it out at. But right now, we're going to check out your feedback. And we're going to start off here with Brian Hillhouse, who says, it's been a while since I've watched this show, and I have no interest in watching it again except for the main event. I always like seeing matches between Flair and Luger from the late 80s and early 90s, and I thought the cage looked awesome. And then there was also the debut. Oh, this was, you're right, the debut of El Gigante, who came out looking like he was the villain in a first-grade play. Hmm. This was also the last appearance of Johnny Ace in WCW.
From Tyler Werner, in retrospect, hindsight being 2020, what a weird show. Undertaker defeated executive vice president of blah blah blah, John Laurinaitis, Teddy Long and Paul Ellering in hair versus hair, women with flair, Gordon Solie doing interviews, and oh yeah, RoboCop. RoboCop, the future of law enforcement, clanks down to the ring to save Sting from the clutches of the evil Four Horsemen. He parked his robo-cruiser outside, came down to robo-fanfare, and left us with robo-memories. How awesome would it have been if Sheamus could give him a brogue kick? The monotone peacekeeper should have traded fists with Sid. And even Haddonis, Hogan did look like a RoboCop knockoff in Suburban Commando. Did I just mention Suburban Commando? I need help.
All right, we go on here to Alan Gaynor. I was and still am a huge RoboCop and wrestling fan, so for those two worlds to meet was pretty cool for me as an 11-year-old at the time. The matches between Flair and Luger were always solid. If someone would only have seen Luger perform in his matches with Flair, they might be under the impression that Luger is one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. The only other highlight for me on the show was the U.S. tag title match. I followed the Z-Man and Pillman's rise to the titles in an 8-team tournament on WCW Worldwide earlier in the year. It was the only WCW program that aired in London, Ontario during that period at the very convenient time of 12:30 a.m. on Mondays. If they had to lose to anyone, I'm glad it was the Midnight Express. Lastly, I was amused by the fact that Mike Rotunda kept the same nickname, Captain, but became a ship captain instead of the leader of a wrestling team. Hey, why throw away a perfectly good nickname? There, a very good point.
Perhaps it was just a coincidence. He's a captain here, and he also owns a ship.
Most collegiate wrestlers own boats.
Mm. From Zach Volk, one month prior to WWF's having about 70,000 at the Sky Dome, and WCW gets about 7,000 for Capital Combat. Some thoughts from the show: WCW had a great pool of tag talent in 1990. The single wrestlers, not so much. I wish RoboCop worked the match because it would settle a question for me. Who is less robotic and more reliable, or more mobile, RoboCop or Lex Luger? If Flair hadn't already been considering it, this had to be his start. This had to start his considering a jump to WWF. It's hard to pick a Scott Putski winner, although I think we settled on Teddy Long. 4 out of 10 for some good talent on the show and the camp value.
All right, we continue onwards here with, all right, Nate Milton. It's always good to take a look back at late 80s, early 90s WCW. This is when they were constantly being overshadowed by the Hogan-led WWF, despite having the superior in-ring product. The first thing that you're struck by as a 2012 viewer is the amount of talent that they had on the roster, especially in the tag division. Not only did the company have great teams at the top like the Road Warriors, the Steiner Brothers, Midnight Express, Doom, and the Freebirds, but they had enough depth to field two separate tag divisions. The RoboCop segment is ridiculously cheesy in hindsight, but as a 12-year-old kid, it was pretty mind-blowing to see RoboCop and Sting interacting with each other. These were two of the biggest heroes of my youth inhabiting the same universe, and it was awesome. My only question as an adult is, what was that actually Peter Weller? I can't imagine him showing up in full costume for a 5-minute segment. Finally, we had the main event. Ric Flair and Lex Luger always worked well together, but this was no exception. Flair was still in his prime in the early 90s, and Luger is a worker who always gets crap from the IWC. But if you actually look at his work from this time period, it holds up pretty well. All in all, this was a decent show, but outside of the RoboCop angle, it was pretty forgettable. It seems like a placeholder card in between two really great shows, Wrestle War 1990 the month before and the Great American Bash the following month. But for some good tag team action and a solid main event, I give this an Officer Alex Murphy approved 6 out of 10. And this was, as I mentioned, Lex Luger was in some rough health here, coming with staph infection, having to work this main event as well to take into consideration.
And our final piece of feedback. The undercard featured a few good matches and some unexpected names. However, let's just cut to the chase and get to the reason why we are watching this show. RoboCop. The moment when RoboCop rescued Zach Morris from the Four Horsemen has aged quite well and is the definition of timeless. It was a moment nobody ever thought they would see, and this feeling was even further cemented by Jim Ross, who was simply incredulous. Regardless of anything else that happened on the show, RoboCop made this pay-per-view worth watching. My only complaint is that we never got to see RoboCop work any programs with the likes of Sid, Luger, or the Black Scorpion. Simply put, WCW Capital Combat 1990 is what dreams are made of, and who knows how many current and former workers became inspired to pursue wrestling because of what they had witnessed. As a matter of fact, former WCW great Chip Minton has gone on record saying that the reason he picked WCW over the Fed was because of the impact RoboCop had on both his personal and professional life. And he gives the show an auto 9 out of 10. FYI, an Auto 9 is the gun that RoboCop uses.
Well, that's great. As long as Chip Minton out there made a difference, then I'm all for RoboCop. So that's going to wrap up our thoughts on WCW Capital Combat 1990. So with that said, let's take a look at next week, Way, and we are going to go in the direction of Ring of Honor, I understand.
Yes, why not? Let's talk about the last Ring of Honor show that just occurred, and this would be great prep for the Toronto show that is about to take place next weekend, Border Wars at the Ted Reeve Arena. So let's look at Showdown in the Sun. What do you want? Night one, night two?
Let's do night two.
Night two, and that features, of course, the Michael Elgin, Davey Richards.
Yes,
which many are
finally you can watch it.
Yes, which many are considering the match of the year thus far. So you can get it all get off my case for not having seen it yet, because I will be watching it next week. And give us your thoughts.
Yes, we'll give you, for those that maybe don't watch the TV, it'll be a bit of a tutorial as well, get you all caught up on what's happening currently in Ring of Honor and kind of set the table for Border Wars, which will be coming up later that weekend. So tune in next week for that. You can always leave your feedback at lawradio.proboards.com. Reviewaway.com will also take you there to the message board. And we are going to be back on Friday with Review and Impact, Saturday with a UFC on Fox post show at 10 Eastern on TSN Radio. And then Sunday night, speaking of Ring of Honor, we will be joined by Kevin Steen and Lance Storm onto the show. They will be chatting about Border Wars and many other things going on. So we will now finish this show off with, I think, the only thing that makes sense, and that is something RoboCop themed to end off our review of Capital Combat, featuring the return of RoboCop.